So good morning, everyone. Today we're going to talk about Torah and science, which is a question that some of you requested. And since it's Parshas Noach, we're going to specifically focus on two Makoros, a Ramban and a Zohar from Parshas Noach. However, I'd like to begin with where we left off last week, and that will hopefully prepare us in one approach for today's discussion. So last week, we discussed the approach of the Rambam about what the Eitz Hadas Tov HaRa is. The Rambam distinguished between Tov HaRa and Emes and Sheker. When humans were originally created, they discerned between Emes and Sheker, but not Tov HaRa. And it was only after they desired and consumed the Eitz Hadas Tov HaRa that they looked at the world through a lens of Tov HaRa. And we talked about two approaches, how to understand what Tov means. And we concluded with the approach of the Rav, who understood that Tov refers to the aesthetic. And man in his original creation didn't appreciate the aesthetic. And his sin related to excessive involvement in the aesthetic. So the Rambam basically tells us that Tov HaRa refer to conventions as opposed to objective truths. Something is good looking is not an objective truth. It's subjective. It relates to convention. And the Rav connected that to a focus on pleasure, an excessive focus on pleasure and the like. And we left off with a question. And the question was that the meaning of the word Tov, then, in the story of the Garden of Eden, is aesthetic or pretty or good tasting. That's the meaning of the word Tov. But clearly, that's not the meaning of the word Tov in Perek Aleph of Bereishis. In Perek Aleph of Bereishis, Hashem creates the world. He creates each day, except for the second day, he says, Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. On the completion of creation, he said, Vihine Tov Ma'od. Now, certainly, the word Tov in that case doesn't mean pretty. So Rav Soloveitchik points this out, and this is the first source on your sheet. And he writes, the terms Tov HaRa constitute homonyms in Hebrew, having both ethical and aesthetic connotations. Meaning to say, the word Tov has more than one meaning. Sometimes the word Tov means aesthetic, like good looking, handsome, good tasting, things like that. And sometimes it refers to that which is right. It has an ethical connotation. Continues the Rav. On the one hand, Tov means the ethically good and right, like la'asos hatova yashar b'nei Hashem. On the other hand, it signifies also the handsome, good-looking, pleasing, and nice. And there are numerous examples of each one. Rambam translates the words tov hara in the story of original fall as meaning the pleasant and the unpleasant, the comfortable and the uncomfortable, or the delightful and the ugly. So one thing to think about is this the same, is this problematic? Is it schwer to say that the word Tov has two totally different meanings, especially because they're just two prakim apart? And in addressing this question, I think we can actually come to an understanding of the Rambam's approach to how to read Ma'aseh Bereishis. And this is something that will also help us address questions of Torah and science. So the Rambam actually writes, as we'll see in a moment, that this phenomenon of words having multiple meaning within the first couple chapters of Bereishis is something that occurs very frequently. And he writes it's the key to understanding these chapters and dealing with the types of questions that relate to Torah and science. In fact, all of Mar Nevuchim was addressed to a person who studied science and philosophy and was disturbed because he saw contradictions between what he studied in Torah and what he studied in science and philosophy. The Rambam's position is that there are no contradictions. They stem from either a misunderstanding of Torah or a misunderstanding of science and philosophy. And oftentimes, they stem from the misunderstanding of Torah. And in addressing how to read and interpret the first chapters of Bereishis, he says, if you correctly understand these chapters, then you won't be bothered by issues of science. So let's take a look. The first thing to keep in mind is that when it comes to the Parshios of Bereishis and all of scripture, the Rambam maintains that you can't deviate from the literal reading unless there are valid grounds. In other words, just because I feel like this doesn't make sense, that's not in and of itself a license to deviate from the literal meaning. You have to have rules. You have to have good reasons. Rambam here is following a tradition of those that came before him, most notably Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon in Emunos Videos, as well as his Akdama to Chumash, lays down four rules that justify deviation from literalism. One of them are when it contradicts proven science. One of them is when it contradicts experience. And the Rambam says a similar point. Before we read the Rambam Nevuchim, he sort of spells out his position succinctly in a letter, which you have over here. It's the next source. This is from the Rambam's essay on Trias HaMesim, his letter on Trias HaMesim. The Rambam wrote this letter because there were those who accused him of not believing in Trias HaMesim. They accused him of this not because he didn't declare his belief. He does. He lists it as one of the Yud Gimel Ikar Yamuna, but because they didn't understand why Trias HaMesim would be so important in light of the Rambam's view that Olam Haba is a non-physical existence. The Rambam defends himself and his belief in Trias HaMesim in this letter. We're not going to read the letter entirely now, but we'll just bring up one small paragraph that's relevant to us. In my discussion in the guide of the creation of the world, I pointed out that it necessarily follows that once the doctrine of the production of the universe is accepted, meaning to say once we accept the concept of Bria Yesh Me'ayin, all miracles are possible. Therefore, resurrection is also possible. What he means to say here briefly is that if you accept the Aristotelian position on the eternity of matter, so it's not just that there's no Bria Yesh Me'ayin, but Nisim are impossible, that Nevuah is impossible. The idea of Aristotle was that God always exists and that the universe always existed, and they really have nothing to do with each other, and they can't have any effect on each other. So the Rambam writes that while we believe in Bria Yesh Me'ayin, and therefore there's nothing problematic about believing in the resurrection. And therefore, since there is no issue with belief in resurrection, in the notion of resurrection, then there's no reason to understand the psukim concerning the resurrection non-literally. Meaning to say, if we felt that the concept of Trias HaMesim is impossible, so then we might be compelled to interpret the psukim that discuss Trias HaMesim, let's say in Daniel, non-literally. But since there's nothing that, there's no compelling reason to interpret them non-literally, then we accept them as literally true. So there will be a literal resurrection. Rambam very famously in Mar Nevuchim writes that the reason why he rejects the notion of the eternity of matter, or the reason why he accepts Bria Yesh Me'ayin, is not actually just because of the text of Bereishis. Because the text of the Bereishis could be read differently. Just like the psukim that imply corporeality are understood non-literally at times, so too, we could have read Bereishis in a way that didn't necessitate the acceptance of Birei Shemayim. Even if you look at Rashi on the first pasuk, Bereishis Bara Elokim, doesn't mean in the beginning God created, but in the beginning of God's creation. So conceivably, we could have read the text in a different way. The reason why we reject Aristotle is two. Number one is because his position is not grounded scientifically. He hasn't proven that he's correct. And moreover, because it contradicts not just the psukim in Bereishis, but all of the Torah. Because according to Aristotle, like we mentioned, there's no possibility of Nisim and there's no possibility of Nevuah. It's not just a single pasuk, but all of Torah is clearly contradicts Aristotle. And that's why we reject his view. He contrasts that with actually Plato's view, who also rejects Birei Shemayim, but would allow for miracles. For him, only the first reason is relevant. So the Rambam continues, and here's an important point. I believe every possible happening that is supported by a prophetic statement and does not strip it of its plain meaning. I fall back on interpreting a statement non-literally only when its plain meaning is impossible, like the corporeality of God. In other words, we could prove God is incorporeal. So therefore, if there's a pasuk that implies he's corporeal, we can't accept the plain meaning. However, as long as there isn't compelling evidence to justify deviating from the literal reading, then of course we have to accept the literal reading. So when it comes to Tchis HaMeisim, there's nothing forcing us to read it non-literally. So we accept Tchis HaMeisim literally. Likewise, when it comes to Birei Shemayim, there's nothing forcing us to read it non-literally. So there too, we accept it literally. That's the approach of the Rambam. So how does that relate to Maaseh Bereishis? Are there parts of Sefer Bereishis, of Maaseh Bereishis, that should be understood non-literally? So before we read what the Rambam says, it's important to point out that the Chazal themselves highlight that our perspective on the first chapter of Bereishis should be different than the rest of Torah. And that's because the Torah's intent is particularly concealed. If we take a look at the Bereishis Rabbah, the next source, Rabbi Levi b'shem Rabbi Chama bar Chanina Amar, Mitchilas ha-sefer ve'ad kan kvod Elokim hester davar, mikan va'elach kvod malachim chakor davar. When it comes to the beginning of Bereishis, kvod Elokim hester davar, meaning to say God's glory is in its concealment. God conceals the true meaning. Maral explains that what this means is that we can't relate to the first parak of Bereishis, because the first parak of Bereishis describes the world prior to the creation of man. And that's not our world. And as such, we can't really relate to it. We certainly can't relate to God as he existed prior to the creation of the universe, because we exist within the universe. But even subsequent to the creation of the universe, but prior to the creation of man, that is not a universe, that is not a world that we occupied. And therefore, we can't really relate to it. So even though we can't relate to it, of course, if it's included in the Torah, we must understand it at some level. So on the one hand, we do treat it differently than other portions, but at the same time, we do have to understand it on some level. That's why the Ramban points out at the beginning of Parshas Bereishis that the first parak of Bereishis can only be understood in a Kabbalistic manner. And that's what Chazal meant when they asked, why did the Torah have to begin with Bereishis? Because since you could only understand this Alpi Kabbalah, the Kabbalah's transmitted from person to person going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. You can't understand it without Kabbalah. And moreover, you can't teach the Kabbalah except to someone who's worthy. So therefore, what's the point of Bereishis? Now you'll tell me, but it's important to know that God created the world. For that, it would be sufficient to say, what it says in the Asar Sadibro suffices. So why do we need all of Perek Aleph? That's what Chazal meant when they were asking why the Torah began with Bereishis. The Rambam, of course, doesn't take that approach in the sense that the Rambam doesn't accept the Kabbalah and the Kabbalistic understanding of Bereishis, but he too understands that Bereishis is talking about esoteric wisdom. As the Gemara says in Chagiga, that Maaseh Bereishis can't be taught publicly. Why? because it contains esoteric wisdom, whether the esoteric wisdom relates to philosophy, relates to Kabbalah, it doesn't really matter. The point is that there are deep secrets here. So more specifically, the Rambam in his Hakdama to Mor Nevuchim tells us how we should relate to this, and that's the next source you have over here, and we'll take a look at it. So we're going to start with this, and then we'll get more specifically to Parshas Noach, because I really want to talk about this week's Parsha. Therefore, the Rambam writes, the Almighty began the Torah with a description of creation, Ma'aseh Bereishis, that is, with physical science on the one hand. The subject is very weighty and important. And on the other hand, our means of fully comprehending those great problems is limited. So we can't really understand it. It's a very important topic to know about, but we're also quite limited. He described those profound truths, which he deemed appropriate to communicate to us, using parables, riddles, and in very obscure words. So here we have three things that he mentions that refer to Ma'aseh Bereishis: parables, riddles, and obscure words. One translation. That's the Pinas translation. I looked at the Friedlander translation. He says allegorical, figurative, and metaphorical language. It's important to get the translation right in general, but especially here, because this is a very controversial issue. Is the first parak of Bereishis meant literally? In the Schwartz translation of the Hebrew, it's b'mashalim b'chidos uvidvarim stumim me'od. So you get the basic idea. Now the Rambam writes that this idea that he's saying is not his invention, but Chazal already make this point. Our sages have said it is impossible to give a full account of the creation of man. Therefore, scripture simply tells us, in the beginning, God created heavens and earth. This is a medrash. The medrash, the lashon of the medrash, is lahagid koach maisa bereishis labrios lodiam efshar elishasasam hakasav. So the medrash tells us that when it comes to Ma'aseh Bereishis, sasam hakasav, mikan amru ein darshan barayos b'shloshah v'lo b'Ma'aseh Bereishis l'shnayim v'lo b'merkav liyachad. Because the Torah is so sane, so therefore it cannot be taught publicly. The Ramban also quotes this medrash. In this manner, they have suggested, meaning Chazal suggested, that this subject is a deep mystery, and in the words of Shlomo, far off, exceedingly deep. Who cannot find it out? That which is said about creation is communicated using equivocal terms, so that the multitude might comprehend them in according with the capacity of their understanding and the weakness of their understanding, whereas the perfect man who is already informed will understand them otherwise. So this is a very interesting idea. What he's saying is that there are words that are used, what he writes, equivocal terms, words that could be understood in two ways. And the masses will understand them the way they understand them. And those who are more worthy, who have studied and prepared, and Talmidei Chachamim and philosophers, they will understand them differently. It can be understood on many levels. That last sentence, I'll read you how the Schwartz translation has it, because it's actually a little more clear. Kol advarim ha'elan emru b'shemos mishutafim, meaning to say a word that could be translated in more than one way. So what does he mean when he talks about these equivocal words, these shemos mishutafim? So first of all, it's very important to emphasize that the Rambam does not tell us what we're meant to understand as a mashal and what we're meant to understand literally. He writes this later on as well in Mor Nevuchim, Chelak Beis, Perek Chavtes, and Lamed, where he deals with this issue again. And he writes in Perek Chavtes, not everything mentioned in the Torah concerning the account of the beginning is to be taken in its external sense as the vulgar imagine. Meaning to say the vulgar, the Hamon Am, understand everything literally, and that's not correct. But it doesn't say everything is non-literal either. As we already saw, the Rambam believes that Briya Yesh Mayin is correct. So some things should be understood in their external sense, and others things shouldn't. The Rambam over there in Beis Chavtes offers examples of the complexity of translating words in this first example. So we'll start with an easy one, which we alluded to last week, an example of the same word having multiple meaning, milim mishutafim. So the first example is Eretz. Eretz, in the first prasuk, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim v'es-ha-aretz, does not mean land, because, as we know, the land was not created until a subsequent day. So it refers to the elemental Eretz, one of the four elements. It's not translated as land. In Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud, it has a different meaning. Now, because what does it say over there? Vayikrali Abasha Eretz. So in Pasuk Yud, it means land. In Pasuk Aleph, it means the element. And what you see from that particular example, and he gives a number, is that the tools of interpretation of this first parak of Bereishis are systematic. They're rooted in the text. It comes from a careful textual analysis. And in this particular case of Eretz, there's no reason to resort to the things like parables or riddles. On the other hand, the Rambam writes, when it comes to, let's say, Rakia, it's much more complex. So I'll read a little bit what he says about Rakia. But there is something hidden, as you will see, with regard to the firmament and the thing above it, which is called water. Skipping a little. If, on the other hand, the matter is considered according to its inner meaning and to what was truly intended, it is most hidden. For in that case, it was necessary for it to be one of the concealed secrets so that the vulgar should not notice. So we're not going to talk about exactly what he means over here. The Rambam's basically saying that the true intention of the word rakia is not what most people assume, but it would be dangerous, it would be problematic to teach this secret to everyone, the secret meaning, the true meaning of rakia. So therefore, it uses a word that could be understood in two ways. The masses will understand it one way, and those who are ra'oi will understand it a different way. The Abar Benel, if you take a look at his commentary on Monavuchim, explains why it is and what this means. He thinks that the masses understand that the word rakia refers to something rigid with water above it and below it. And the literal reading of Bereishis supports this view, but that's not the true intent of the Torah. So that's an example of a secret. But the word that I want to talk to you about, which is a little more relevant for us, I think, is the meaning of the word yom. So what have we've seen already three examples of this approach. We started off with the meaning of tovara, that the word tov has one meaning in Perek Aleph, a different meaning in Perek Gimel. Perek Aleph and Perek Gimel are different. We saw that's true with respect to Yom. It's true with respect to Rakia. I'm sorry, not we didn't do Yom yet. It's true with respect to Eretz. It's true with respect to Rakia. Now we're going to talk about the word Yom. So Yom is a great example because it's obvious that the meaning of the word Yom, when it's first used, is not the typical meaning of the word Yom. What's the typical meaning of the word Yom? Yom is a unit of time, which represents the time that it takes for the earth to complete one rotation with respect to the sun, or from the perspective of someone standing on the earth, the time it takes for the sun to encircle the earth. But clearly, that can't be the meaning of the word Yom, as the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, again, this is Chelek Beis Perek Lamed, points out. There's really two issues. First of all, the Torah uses the word Yom prior to the creation of the sun. so can't mean the standard definition of yom, because the standard definition of yom includes the sun, the rotation around the sun, or with respect to the sun, not around the sun, that's a year. And the second issue is that the Rambam tells us that time itself is a creation by God. And people that think that time always existed are accepting basically Aristotle's position concerning the eternity of matter. Says they might unknowingly be accepting that view, but they are, which is also interesting, Agav, because I think the Rambam writes that there were certain people in Chazal who accepted that view, but that's a different issue. So the Rambam tells us that time was also a creation. So if Yom refers to a unit of time, then Pasuk Hey would be making an illogical statement, because it would be saying God created time within time, because the first day included the creation of time, and a day is a unit of time. So how could a unit of time include the creation of time? That would make no sense. So therefore, it's obvious that Yom cannot, in this context, be a unit of time. So then what does it mean? In other words, just to make that point clear, when the Pasuk says that God created the world in 6 days, that cannot mean days as in a unit of time, because that creation story included the creation of time, and you can't create time in time. So, parenthetically, the Rambam also maintains that Chazal in a number of places hold, like Rashi alludes to, that God created everything simultaneously. So obviously, if everything was created simultaneously, when we talk about the first day, the second day, third day, etc., can't be days in the classical sense. So, okay. So now we know that the word day in Bereshis does not mean what it usually means. So then what then does it mean? What does it mean that God created light and dark on the first day, and this on the second day, and this on the third day? So the Rambam answers this question, but it's not entirely clear what his answer is. And in fact, the Mefarshei HaRambam take two different approaches. So either he's saying that the days refer to the chronological stages in which the creations emerged. In other words, when it says that the grass and the trees were created on the third day, it means that they were created in the third stage of creation, but not literally in the third day, but in the third stage. So there were 6 stages of creation. And in the third stage of creation, that's when the grass was created. And the 6th stage of creation, that's when mammals were created. The Torah is telling us the stages of creation, but it's nothing to do with units of time. How long they were, that's not at all discussed in the Torah. The second approach is that the Rambam thinks that the Torah isn't even describing that. Actually, what the Torah is describing is a certain type of hierarchy in a natural world. There's a hierarchy with man at the top, but it doesn't mean that, it's not even referring to a chronology. I'll read to you the passage in question. I'll read it to you first in the Hebrew translation, the Schwartz translation, and then I'll read you the English translation, which you have in your sheets, both of them, which is from the Friedlander translation, and you'll see the ambiguity here. So here's what it says. Mikan shakol nivra yachad, vadvarim nivdalu kulam bezachar ze, ad shehem shilu zos leichar. Again, he's quoting this medrash. Asher pizer zraim shonim ba'adama bedaka achas. Chalkam navat lachar yom, chalkam lachar yomayim. So you sprinkle a bunch of seeds on the floor, and some of them sprout after a day and some after a couple of days. The chalkam lachar shlosha, ba'od azriya kula haisa b'sha'achas. Got English? Consequently, all things were created together, but were separated from each other successively. Our sages illustrated this with the following mashal. We sow various seeds at the same time. Some spring forth after one day, some after two, some after three, although all have been sown at the same time. So there are those that say, this tells us, that we're not even talking about chronology, but we're talking about a hierarchy. Others understand it, I think, the simpler way, which is that there's a chronology. In other words, some sprouted after day one, some after day two, some after day three, that we are dealing with chronology. Who takes the second approach, which is obviously the more mechudash approach, that there's not even a chronology here, it's a hierarchy. So a lot of the classical mefarshim take this approach. The Abar Benel, when quoting the Rambam in Bereishis Perek Aleph, accepts this approach. Take a look, last week's parsha, he writes explicitly, lo kedimazmanit. When the Rambam's view is cited, he's saying it's achronological. The Akedas Yitzchak, or Yitzchak Arama, writes the similar point. Again, when presenting the Rambam, he writes, the description of creation is not describing the chronological sequence of events. The days simply serve to indicate distinctions in their level and to inform us of the nature of creation. Ibn Falkwara, who is another Rishon who has a commentary on the Mor Nevuchim, takes this approach as well. It's interesting, why don't they take the first approach, that this is a chronology? So it might be because of what Rambam writes a little bit later in the chapter, that Aristotle would have rejected any type of temporal dimensions. The difficulty is that he rejects Aristotle's reading. And over there, anyway, he's just quoting Aristotle. He doesn't say it's correct. So I'm not sure why these Mefarshim take the second approach. But one way or the other, again, the Rambam's telling us either, again, that when we talk about Yamim in creation, we're not talking about days. And either we're talking about the stages of creation, or we're just talking about a hierarchy in a natural world. Yes, Zev.
If it's talking about the hierarchy, isn't like a major question that I think man is a lot more chashuva of an animal. So why would man be created last if it's a hierarchy?
That's the hierarchy. He's the tip. He's the pinnacle. Everybody's
going the opposite way. I mean, the day sure. Six is fine.
But even if you don't read like the Rambam, that's probably going to be true. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik has a very interesting article on the Torah's perspective on women, and he points out that you see from there that women are higher than men because they're created after man, and clearly creation is a hierarchy. So anyway, so now it's worthwhile to note again that when the Rambam presents this approach, first of all, the way he presents it is that this is the view of Chazal, A, and B, he comes to it from internal textual reasons. He doesn't simply just say, well, there's an issue from science, so this is what we're going to have to say. That might be part of it, but that's not the way he proves it in the Mor Nevuchim. He shows it both from that this is correct, both from internal textual issues, like we said, the meaning of day can't be the standard meaning because there was no sun on the first day, and also from support in Chazal. Okay, do you have a question, Maximilian? Put your hand down.
I did. I was just curious, and the answer might just be that it just is what the Torah is saying, but along the idea of there's a chronology, like, is there any, like, would he discuss like the logic of the chronology in that like light is first followed by
So there might be.
What does that mean?
In other words, I think it might be true that Bracha, I'm sorry, I'm in shir. I'm going to come to you later. Okay. Okay. Go ahead. My daughter wasn't feeling well this morning, so I'm not home alone today. So the answer is that yes, surely there is an order. And the idea of a hierarchy might still be true. It's just the question is, does it have nothing? Is it entirely a hierarchy, nothing having to do with chronology? Or is it a chronology that might represent a hierarchy? But yes, it's certainly not arbitrary, even if it is chronology, what the chronology is.
It was arbitrary. I was just asking if there was like a proposed logic to
So the Rambam may allude to it a little bit, but I don't think he doesn't really develop it. Okay. Now, the Rav notes the implications of this understanding of the Rambam in terms of the interpretation of the order of creation. And the Rav writes that what the Rambam is telling us, and this is in a sense obvious, but it's worthwhile to spell out, which is that the Torah is not telling us anything about the age of the universe. The most you could possibly say is that the Torah is telling us about how long it's been since the creation of Adam, but it's not telling us anything about the age of the universe, because when we talk about 6 days, we're not talking about 6 units of time. It's not just that, well, a day in creation was a much longer period of time. No, it's telling us nothing about time. We have no idea from the Torah when in time the universe was created or when there was this creation of time. Now, it's important to note that the Ramban in Perek Aleph Pasuk Gimel rejects this understanding of the Rambam. And he says that days in Perek Aleph of Bereishis are literal days. The Ramban then adds, though, that according to the deeper Kabbalistic understanding, the Yamim refer to Sfiros. The 7 days correspond to Sfiros. It is interesting that the Rav, in this piece which you have over here, we could look at it quickly. This is a piece from the notes that someone took when attending the Rav's Shiurim in Revel on Mor Nevuchim. And they were written by somebody named Robert Blau. They were edited by Rav Meir Treibitz. Meir Treibitz is a Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, a very interesting fellow. And he edited and annotated these lectures of the Rav. And they've been recently published in Chakira magazine. So this is from a lecture 7. So I'll read it quickly. Again, how reliable this is, it's hard to know exactly. This isn't something that somebody wrote. These are notes that a student in the class took from what he said. So you should keep that in mind. But this is what it says. Indeed, one of the most annoying scientific facts with which the religious man encounters is the problem of evolution and creation. However, this is not the real problem. This is an idea that the Rav says many places, like in the beginning of Lonely Man of Faith, that he writes, you know, I'm bothered by a lot of issues, but Torah and science is not one of them. What actually is irreconcilable is the concept of man as the bearer of a divine image and the idea of man as an intelligent animal in science. In other words, the problem isn't evolution. The problem is the scientific description of man entirely physically, not as Tzelem Elokim. That's something that Torah and science are divided about, as we've talked about in the first Shiurim. But that's not a kasha either. Evolution and creation can be reconciled merely by saying that 6 days is not absolutely so, but is indefinite and may be longer. Maimonides spoke of creation in terms of phases, as we just saw, and the Kabbalah in terms of spheros, like the Ramban says, the time of which may be indefinite. In other words, if the first If the days of creation are stages, or the days of creation are spheros, either way, it's not telling us about the age of the universe. However, our conflict is man as a unique being and man as a friend of the animal. Science can never explain how being came into being, for it is out of the realm of science. While the Bible is concerned with the problem of ex nihilo, meaning to say that Torah and science are addressing two different types of questions. Science does not address the question. Science nowadays, at least for the most part, believes that there was a beginning, whether you call it the Big Bang or whatever you call it. It doesn't address the question of what started it all, because that's metaphysics. It's not physics. It's not a question that science could even address. So really, they're different realms. Aristotle could not accept evolution because he believed in the eternity of forms. The Rav basically writes in this essay, you could take a look at it more in detail, but he writes that whether you learn like the Rambam or the Ramban, there is no issue here. Now, it's interesting because, again, the Ramban is a little less clear, because the Ramban does seem to say al pi pshat yom is the standard yom. But the Rav was reading the Ramban as saying that after rejecting the Ramban says yom does mean a unit of time. And then he says it actually, the deeper understanding is spheros. You could have understood that as replacing the simple understanding or in addition to the simple understanding. The Rav seems to understand it as replacing the simple understanding. So therefore he says, whether you learn like the Rambam or the Ramban, the Torah is really not telling us anything about the age of the universe. So that's something that's very important to keep in mind. Now I want to turn to, even though we don't have that much time left, to our Parsha. And as I said, two Makoros in our Parsha that deal with or will help us deal with the issue of Torah and science and Stiras. So the first is a Ramban, Perek Tes, Pasuk Yud Beis. We'll read it together and then we'll consider the implications. Zos os habris asher ani nosein. So this pasuk is, of course, taking place after the flood. Noach leaves the teva. He offers the karbanos, and there is a keshes, a rainbow, and God tells Noach a very uplifting message. Says the Ramban, hamishamish min haos hazeh shelo haya keshes. Sorry, hamashma min haos hazeh shelo haya keshes be'anan imaisa. Voracious. When you read this psukim at first, you get the impression that this was the first rainbow. There was never a rainbow until now, and that's why the rainbow is a bris. It's a covenant in which God tells us he will never again destroy the world in a flood. Vata barashem chadasha lasos keshes b'shamayim b'yom anan. So the psukim sound like God has now created something new, the rainbow. V'amru b'tama os hazeh ki hakeshes Right, so we know that the word keshes in Hebrew means the rainbow. In this context, it also refers to a bow, as in a bow and arrow, a weapon. So what's the symbolism? The bow, if I was shooting at you, so the arc of the bow would be towards you. So if somebody wants to show a sign of peace, what would they do? They would turn their bow and arrow around. The bow would, the open end, as it were, would be facing what was once the enemy. And that's a sign that we're at peace. Right? I'm like turning the gun and facing it towards me, not towards you. So that's the symbolism. The rainbow is a bow, which is a weapon, but it's facing backwards. And moreover, there's no bow. There's no arrows in the bow, it's just the bow. So that's the simple understanding. So the simple understanding is that the first rainbow to ever exist was created after the flood. Says the Ramban, "Vanachnu al korchenu na'amin l'divrei ha'yivanim, shemilat ha'shemesh halach yakeshes betolda." But al korchenu, we have to accept the view of the Yavanim, the Greeks, the scientists, and scientists tell us that a rainbow is a natural phenomenon. Rainbow comes from the light going, refracting through the prisms of the raindrops and creating this phenomenon called a rainbow. Just look at, use a prism and you'll see the same thing. So therefore, in light of what science teaches us, we can't interpret the pasuk this way, because the pasuk sounds like this is a supernatural phenomenon, but in fact, the Greeks have taught us that it is a natural phenomenon. A rainbow is just the refracting of light. It's not a miracle. It's science, basic science. We all learned it when we were little kids. And says the Ramban, so we have to re-examine the pasuk. Now, the Ramban does not wholeheartedly or always endorse the Greek scientific perspective. He's at times very harsh and fiercely rejects the Greek view. Ramban was especially perturbed with the perspective of the Greeks and scientists that the only things that exist are things that we can observe. If you can't find it, if you can't observe it, if you can't measure it, then it doesn't exist. Ramban says that's absolutely wrong. So Ramban rejects much of Greek science and philosophy, but where it makes sense, where it's proven, he accepts it. And this is something that he accepts as something that makes sense. And he adds, "V'kasher nistakel od b'lashon ha'kasuv navin kein." Moreover, if we look carefully at the pasuk, we'll understand that the pasuk does not necessarily tell us that this was a new creation, that this was an ace, that this was something that never previously existed. Ki amar es kashti nasati ba'anan, in past tense. The lo amar ash ani nosein ba'anan. In other words, if this was a new creation, the rainbow, so it should have said, es kashti ani nosein ba'anan, I'm hereby placing my keshes in the anan to serve as a symbol that I won't destroy the world any longer. Kasher amar zos os habris asher ani nosein. When it comes to the bris, it's in present tense. So why, with respect to the keshes, is it in past tense? Asher nasati. Umilas kashti more, shahaisa lo hakeshes tchila. So what does this teach us? That the keshes always existed. It's not the pshat that this was the first rainbow ever. There may have been rainbows before this. V'lachein nefaresh hakasuv, hakeshes asher nasati ba'anan miyom habriya, tiyeh min hayom hazeh v'hala, this keshes that always existed, henceforward, will be a bris between you and me. Azkir ki bris shalom. Whenever I see this keshes, I will remember the bris. So that's the first source that I want to see with you, which is, again, the Ramban is taking science into account when interpreting the pasuk. He's doing so carefully. He shows, after all, that this is in fact a more precise reading of the text. It's more meduyak. But he also tells us that science is relevant. Al korcheinu namin l'divrei yevanim. So what role does science play in the interpretation of Torah? According to the Rambam and Ramban, it plays a role. Is it the only factor? No. We have to be very careful. But it would be inaccurate to say that it should be entirely ignored. The next source that I want to see with you is a Ramban, a Maral from the Ber HaGola. Ber HaGola is one of the works of the Maral. It's a little different than actually all of his other works. It's a defense against critiques of Chazal. The truth is, he's always defending critiques of Chazal, even in Gur Aryeh, which is a Perush on Chumash. That's really what he's doing, because by defending Rashi, Rashi usually presents Chazal. But here it's a more explicit work on that topic. These are the tie notes that people have on Chazal, and this is their resolution, this is their refutation. It's very important work to learn. You'll see that many of the tainos that people had against Chazal 500 years ago are the same ones that people have nowadays. And we'll begin here with the Ber Hashishi. Hatluna Hashishis, the sixth taina they have on Chazal, Be'amram, Kiyayan Elam Mehem Chachma Hanoshis. They claim that Chazal didn't know human wisdom. Heim hachachmos asher lefi hasechel anoshi. The lo sheya ne'elam mehem, v'kdibru bahem betachlis hazaras. So Chazal didn't know science. And not only don't they know science, but they replaced it with these strange assumptions. You read many Chazals about all sorts of physical phenomena, and you'll see all sorts of strange things, which these critics claim show that Chazal didn't know science. Skipping a little, the davar ze imayakach hayamora ze al chisarona yediyah v'chakamina emes. The davar ze hefach mashesiru alav chachamim. If this were true, it would be a very, very big problem, because Chazal themselves are very much into accepting truth. And Chazal tell us, he quotes the Gemara in Yevamos, based off of Psukim, Emor l'chachma chosiat, that you should only say something if you know it well. You shouldn't talk about things that you are ignorant in. So if Chazal were giving scientific explanations of things and they didn't know science, so they would be contradicting their own words. So clearly, that's not what Chazal were doing. So let's see, what were they doing? V'chachmos sh'amru aleim sh'dibru b'em zaros, ki ha'chachmos tivis v'chachma limudis. V'kvar nizbar l'cha, ki kol sh'hevi'um l'davar zeh l'achshov ha'chachamim kach, zehu ma sh'matzu b'dvarihem sh'nasnu sibos l'dvarim tivim, sh'nishavim ba'olam, v'yanir alahem, ki ha'sibos ha'elo, hem rechokim, sh'yia davar zeh siba tivit. V'shvil zeh amru aleim sh'hayu rechokim mi'chachmos elo. Aval ein ha'emes kach, klal. Ki lo ba'u chachamim ledaber min ha'siba ha'tivis. Ki katon ufachos ha'siba ha'tivis. Ki davar ze ye'us l'chachmei ha'teva. O l'rofim. O lo l'chachamim. Aval heim zal dibru min ha'siba shemechayev ha'teva. V'ha'makhish davar ze, makhish ha'emuna v'ha'torah. So what's he saying? A very important point. He's saying, look, why do they think that Chazal were ignorant in science? Because they see Chazal giving explanations for physical phenomena. And they assume that they are giving the physical explanation for the physical phenomena, a scientific explanation for a scientific phenomena. But that's not what they were doing. Chazal were not scientists, and they were not interested in teaching the scientific explanation. Chachamim were looking for the siba shemechayev hateva, not the scientific explanation for the scientific phenomenon, but what's behind the scientific explanation. What is the ultimate cause? And that's what they're doing. So when people say, oh, Chazal made mistakes in science, that's because they misinterpret Chazal. They think that Chazal were giving a scientific explanation. It's similar to what we talked about before in Bereishis Perek Aleph. If you think that Bereishis Perek Aleph is explaining in scientific terms the creation of the world, then there are problems. But that's not what they're interested in doing. What are they interested in? What's the Torah interested in that case? The Torah is interested, let's say, according to the Ramban, in teaching these Kabbalistic secrets, teaching us about the Sfiros. And the Maral gives an example of this from this week's Parsha, the example of the rainbow. And we'll skip a little bit, see what he says over here. Kemoshis bar lamala sha'amra Torah es os hakeshes v'ra isiha lizkor bris olam. V'chachmei ha'teva nasnu siba tiv'it hakeshes. Kemo shi'adu amidivrahim. Aval davar, hadavar hukach. She'asiba sher nitna ha'Torah hu ha'siba. שלכל דבר יש סיבה טבעית מחייב עושה. ועל עושה סיבה טבעית, יש סיבה אלוקיס, והוא סיבה ססיבה. וזהו, ומזה דיברו חכמים. So, let's look at the psukim. When the Torah tells us of the association between the rainbow and God's bris not to destroy the world, so they aren't giving the Torah is not giving the scientific explanation of the rainbow. It's not explained. The scientific explanation is correct. It's refraction of light. But that's not what the Torah is interested in doing. The Torah is giving us the reason behind the reason. Why, I suppose, was the world created in such a way where this phenomenon of refraction exists? In other words, you're misunderstanding the agenda of the Torah. And likewise, you're misunderstanding the agenda of Chazal. Just to give another example from Chazal, he gives the example, you'll read on, of the Ramach Evarim, Ushasagidim. That is not a lesson in anatomy. It is probably true that if you go to anatomy class, they will give you a very different explanation of how many limbs and sinews there are. I don't even know what a sinew is. But the point is that these things, 365, reflects a deeper meaning. That's why it's connected, mitzvah saseh and mitzvah lo saseh, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Chazal were teaching us a secret, a deeper understanding of the nature of human, how all of the parts of a human correspond to mitzvos, and through them, a person will achieve shlemos, b'chulei. And I guess what we'll stop with this, though we're only really halfway through what I wanted to do today. But the Rav has a very important essay. We've referred to this essay before, The Halachic Mind. And the Rav develops an idea called what he calls epistemological pluralism. And if you understand this approach, which is really what's coming out of the Maral, you'll understand that you don't have to worry about these types of scientific questions, as we saw the Rav point out. We'll just read just a little bit from this essay, and we'll try to explain it briefly, and then we'll stop. Epistemological pluralism has not abandoned the realm of logic. It says only that reason itself leads the physicist, psychologist, philosopher, and homo religiosus to a pluralism of viewpoints. The heterogeneity of knowledge, however, is not based upon a manifold methods employed by theoreticians, but upon the plurality of the objective orders they encounter. In other words, science and religion deal with two different issues. They reflect two different perspectives, and they could both be true. And even though it might seem like they contradict each other, they don't. There's epistemological pluralism. Pluralism in the sense that they could both be true. They're two different perspectives. And there's no stira. The Rav points out that this model of looking at the world, looking at Torah, looking at science is particularly compelling in light of 20th century science and things like quantum physics, which no longer posits a unified intuitive view of the world. It used to be, whether you take an Aristotelian approach to the universe or a Newtonian perspective. So there's one way in which things worked, a set of rules, and everything works together. With quantum physics, we know that that's not true. There are different things, wave-particle duality. How could they both be, how could light be a wave and a particle? There's no resolution. Somehow it is. And that's a great muscle for epistemological pluralism. And therefore, a person won't be bothered by questions of science because scientists, like we saw in the Maral, are trying to do a different thing. Scientists are trying to explain a physical phenomenon, and Torah is trying to do something else. Rav Kook, again, emphasizes a very similar point that no scientific evidence will be harmful to religion because they have these totally different agendas. Scientists are out to discover the revealed physical reality, to understand the created world, the corporeal world, and religion is all about knowledge of God and morality. and it has nothing to do with science. And you see, by the way, people make this mistake in many different ways. One is they see steers between science and religion, but also they turn to science for the wrong questions. For example, let's say the end of life issues and the definition of death. And they say, okay, well, let's see, what does biology tell us? Biology doesn't tell you anything about how to define death, because death isn't a scientific issue. In other words, is it brain death? Is it circulatory death? What is death? That's not a biological question. Biology could tell you when the brain stops functioning or when the heart stops beating, but it can't define death. So if you go ahead and you say, well, science has shown us that brain death is death, that just shows that you don't know what science is. I'm not taking a stand whether it is death or not death in terms of halacha. That's not my department. But thinking that you could look at science to answer that question is just misunderstanding science. Science tells you nothing about the definition of death, because death is not a scientific question. Anyhow, there's really much more to say about this point. I'll think about whether we could, if you continue this topic next week or start a new sugya. Either way, I want to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, and Be'ezras Hashem, we'll pick up next week.
Have a good Shabbos, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank
you, Rabbi. Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you.
If anybody wants to stay for questions, they can. Yeah. Go ahead, Zachary.
Even if we say within the Ramban about the days of creation that it was talking about like actual days, and you don't get into spheros or anything, is it problematic to just say that God created the world at a certain age? Like every rock he created was like a very, very old rock.
I don't know of any problem with saying that.
Uh-huh. Like, why isn't that just like a very reasonable approach? That
it is a very reasonable approach. It sort of raises an interesting question, which is, why would he? In other words, on the one hand, it's very reasonable, like you're saying, you know, when Adam was created, you know, on day one, and you would have taken him, as it were, to a physician for a checkup. So would they say that, you know, probably his body would look like a adult, you know, body? He wasn't created like an infant. So likewise, if Adam wasn't created as an infant, so maybe all of creation wasn't created as an infant. And that would explain the evidence that the universe is a lot older than it is. The question, though, on that approach, to just using that approach to answer the question is, well, why did he do that? Was God just trying to fool us? In other words, by making a universe that looks like it was around for billions of years, so when it's not. So, you know, to say he buried the dinosaur bones, he created a world with buried dinosaur bones. So why did he do that? So we don't know. We can't answer that question. We don't know why God does anything. We don't know why he created the world either.
I was going to say, like, that's once you like go down that route, you could ask that about so many parts of creation. Like,
so that's absolutely true. And the Rambam himself writes that in Mor Nevuchim, that there are certain types of questions like why he created the world that we can't answer. Maybe another shiur we could have on the purpose of creation, and because there are sources that seem to try to answer that question, but the Rambam writes that we can't answer that question. So that approach to take is certainly a valid approach. But if you asked, you know, what's the drawback, I think it might strike some people as a little funny that he would have, created the world with these scars. It's interesting. If you look at the Tiferes Yisrael, Tiferes Yisrael says that he quotes the sources in Kabbalah that discuss the that God created worlds and destroyed them and built new worlds on the destroyed old worlds. And that's the way he understands those types of things. In fact, when they first discovered the first fossils of dinosaurs, or if not dinosaurs, I think they were woolly mammoths, older creatures, Pharisee Yisrael, you know, some people are very nervous about these things. He was so excited. He says, ah, you see, that's exactly what Chazal said, that bona olam osu machrivam. So.
Thank you.
Sure.
Maybe if I may add, I always understood the purpose of creation of dinosaurs or the creation of the world as being so old as having to do with a pasuk and I think either Ekev or Re'eh. Mm-hmm. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Elilin Asher Cholak Lahem. Actually, there quotes the measures that HaKadosh Baruch Hu let the Umos HaOlam be machlik, you know, he give him pitfall with these. So maybe that's how I always understood it. If that makes sense or not.
So that's what you're saying. Okay. I hear. Look, there's, you know, I don't think there's one right approach, and we have to be very aware of our ignorance and you know, that to a larger degree, whatever we say is speculative in these realms. Okay.
Just regarding the Ramban, but the sixth parasha, but the Keshes. Uh-huh. If the Keshes always existed, so then how could that be an os? Meaning the os has to be something new.
So that's interesting. So the Ramban doesn't say that, right? The Ramban writes that it, you know, it's being rebranded, and that an os doesn't have to be something new. He makes that point exactly. Umilas kashti morish ha'isa lo ha'keshes mitchila. Now, it could be that if we put together the Maral and the Ramban, we could say as follows. God always knew about what was going to happen. And so he created this phenomenon of the rainbow. And now he's telling the world that henceforward, this will be a bris that you and I see that represents this understanding.
Okay.
Shkayach.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Have a good Shabbos.